Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. You know, all I could think about this morning is the term, "Whoa, Nelly." That's all that came to mind this morning as I was preparing for Scoop. And I don't even know where that term came from. I did a little work. I did a little research. Where does that term actually come from? Because all I picture is a horse, you know, like, "Whoa, Nelly." Turns out it's a little bit more difficult to uncover than a simple Google search. So we're just going to enjoy the phrase. And if I say, "Whoa, Nelly," you know exactly what I mean. Whoa, Nelly, when it comes to the developments of several big news stories over the last several days. And we are preparing for a week where, yes, we always leave room for the unexpected, but the schedule itself is showing us that it is going to be full of opportunities for a lot of news developments. And so this is a great time to come together, set a foundation for the week. We'll have a cheat sheet of really important things that you should know as you enter into this news week. We have Barbara, who's live, a Scoop insider with us today. She shared with us earlier in our before show that she's on a social media cleanse. Scoop not included. This is because she's not viewing this on social media. As you know, you can view Scoop through a podcast. You can join us as an insider and chat with us live during this broadcast, which is really fun. I love getting to know you guys there. We're really getting to know each other, aren't we? The insider group. And we're getting to connect and find out where everyone is. We know Jeremy from Oklahoma. We have Jennifer coming from Italy, a military spouse from Italy that's joining us live today. So we're worldwide. That's what we're doing right now. We're worldwide. And this is a great time to take a breath away from the frenetic pace that we do see on social media, just trying to keep up with things, because it has been that sort of a news cycle. And interestingly enough, there's a little bit of maybe a metaphor we can use with the storm. We've been tracking this storm, Hurricane Beryl. It made landfall today in Texas. There's been all sorts of questions about how big this storm would be, how devastating it would be. And there's something about the storm that we can compare to a news cycle, where sometimes a news cycle will blow in and then quickly blow out. It'll come, sit for a second, and go. You have other news cycles where they continue to churn and they're not moving. And right now we're in a news cycle that is churning and not moving when it comes to the current status of President Biden and whether or not he's going to stay in this presidential race. We have a ton of other news to get to, but we have a lot of developments on that front. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I do have a couple quick things for you as we get started, because there are some stories around the world that are important to talk about. And I want to make sure you have those on your radar. Kind of consider this, like, this is your, again, like your little prep sheet of things that you should know about. We're not going to go in depth on it, but I think you should know about them. And then we're going to get into the tough stuff. We're going to talk about President Biden. We're going to talk about President Trump. We're going to talk about Project 2025. We've gotten a lot of questions about that. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court, and not the ruling necessarily on presidential immunity, although you know we're going to wrap that in. We're going to talk about the overturn of a ruling called Chevron. And there's been a lot of questions from you about this, as well as what does this mean for who is the authority when it comes to certain questions about policies or laws in this country. So we got a lot to get to. I had a great time answering many of your questions over the weekend, actually on social media. As some of you know, my family and I were in the area where Hurricane Beryl was expected. We weren't quite sure, but there was an expectation that it could come that direction. So we ended up leaving a little bit early and we had a long drive home. So I was answering a lot of your questions on all sorts of different news topics. It was actually great prep for this show. But one of you asked a really good question that was hard for me to answer, but I thought I could share it with you now, which is, what do you do to decompress? The simplest questions are the hardest ones to answer. What do you do to decompress? So I actually have a suggestion that has nothing to do with news. This is a palate cleanser before we get into the tough stuff. I just read a really good fiction book. And it can be very difficult for me to get through books. I'm reading so much all the time. I love to read. And yet for some reason over the last couple of years, it's been difficult to keep pace. So I have a great book recommendation for you that also gives us a lesson going into Scoop. And this book is called Listen for the Lie by Amy Tintera. Listen for the Lie. Listen for the Lie is the name of a podcast show that is a unsolved crimes podcast show. That's all I'm going to tell you. But you get to go through and retrace an unsolved murder. And you get some answers at the end, but it's a really quick, fast-paced read. Kathy, you say that you love this book. It's an easy book to like because you also don't know who's guilty of this really sad murder in this small town. By the way, a small town in the Hill Country of Texas, which is exactly where I'm sitting. Hopefully this is just, it was just fiction, but anyway, this is a great book. Listen for the Lie. If you need a good summer read, this is a good one. The reason why I wanted to mention at the beginning of this podcast too, is because there's a real lesson in this book. At the end, I was reading about Amy Tintera, the author, because this is her kind of debut adult novel. And I was curious about her. Turns out she actually has a journalism degree. And when you look at the lesson from this book, one of the lessons is, consider the source and how we can make judgments without even knowing it about information based on a source or what we think of a source. And it's a really important lesson in journalism. You have to consider the source. And if there's one lesson we can talk about today, as we're looking through all sorts of different reports on all sorts of different topics, and you're seeing a lot of wild things online. I saw all sorts of crazy things online, rumors unsubstantiated that could be potentially huge headlines, an irresponsibility I haven't seen in a long time. And this is where a free press and journalists really should step into the fray and show the public that you can trust us. Because when it gets so chaotic like this, this is an opportunity for the press. The pandemic was that opportunity. I don't believe we rose to the occasion. So this is an opportunity for the press at this time. And I understand how it can feel really confusing and overwhelming. I was chasing something down on Twitter this weekend because it was enough of a rumor. I'm not even going to mention it, that I had to see if it was real, because if it was, then it could be big news. Turns out it was not. It's a tough time right now. So we have to consider the source. We really have to consider the source. Okay, let's talk about a couple things real quick. Let's talk about Hurricane Beryl. As I just mentioned, Hurricane Beryl made landfall in Texas. We're continuing to watch the progress of this storm. There's a really interesting nugget to know about this storm that has been very destructive as it made its way towards the Gulf of Mexico. And that is that the storm was not really able to organize itself completely coming to the coast of Texas because of what? Because of dust. Dust clogged up this storm and slowed it down. What dust am I talking about? Dust from Africa. Yes, this is true. If you live in Texas, you will hear periodically about the dust from the Sahara blowing across the Atlantic, and it can actually cause air quality issues here. Well, in this particular case, there was enough dust that was in the air that it gunked up the hurricane and slowed it down. So it wasn't able to really garner all the strength, the destructive strength that it needed to get into a bigger category storm. Kind of an interesting fact to know. And so I just want to read this from a local meteorologist, Andrew Tate. He said this: for a hurricane to form in the Atlantic, you need moisture. And if you've got this dry air full of the Saharan dust, it means that it can limit tropical development. And so that's one of the reasons why we didn't see this storm go further. It is important to know that the prediction for hurricane season, which lasts until later, you know, the next couple months, is that we're going to see a more active season. And that typically we see typically you see just over a dozen storms that are named storms a season. And the prediction is for 17 to 25. So the prediction is for a more active season. And the weather is a great reminder that we can't control everything and that something can become a big news story out of nowhere. You know, Hurricane Katrina is an example of that, which was a devastating hurricane because of the flooding that came afterwards, specifically in New Orleans, despite the strength of the storm. And so as we're moving through this election season where there's a lot of prognostication, where there's a lot of prediction about what to come, the weather's also a great reminder for us that we don't know everything that's coming. And there can be a big event that comes out of nowhere that suddenly the media will pay attention to, where it could have a broader impact. You know, a big storm like this could have impact on the job market, on energy, oil production, that could impact the entire U.S. economy. So it's a great reminder of that. We're grateful that this storm does not seem as destructive as it once was, but it's a great reminder of those type of stories to watch out for as we go towards Election Day. And really, hurricane season lasts right until just after Election Day. So an important thing to think about. We also had this weekend, just going into this weekend, I'm going to show this to you really quickly, just speaking about the job market. We did get some news on the job market on Friday. We just had over 200,000 jobs created last month in the month of June. And the reason why I'm showing these charts, you don't really get to zoom in on them. I just want you to see trends over the last 2 years. You can see that on the left-hand side, you see the unemployment rate sort of going up a little bit, and then you see job creation sort of coming down. That is, we still have a historically low unemployment rate, and our job creation is still around the 200,000 mark, which is about what we need to keep up with population growth. This does show a slightly cooling job market, which is what some economists want to see as a sign that maybe inflation is finally working its way out of the system. We can't say that completely, and there's a lot of other factors, but it's another reason to pay close attention to the job market and job data. And if we saw a crazy big job creation or big job numbers, it would spark more fears of inflation in the system, which then could affect the stock market and could affect, you know, everyone that's trying to figure out how to place their trades or what to do because of inflation. So I just want you aware that that report came out. Also, over the weekend, we had some movement when it comes to leadership in Europe for some of our key allies, the UK and also in France. And we know that this is going to be a huge election year all over the world. You have billions of people that are voting. So it is a transitional period in the United States as far as politics goes. But really all over the world, we're seeing a lot of different elections take place and some unexpected, where we're seeing these snap elections take place in parliamentary systems. It's really important to be careful about the language that we use. You know, we use liberal and conservative so freely. We use the term coalition so freely. But our system is different than these systems of government, and it doesn't exactly parallel. So we want to make sure to keep that in mind. Here is the new prime minister for Britain, Keir Starmer. And I just want to read you this. I thought this was interesting. Britain's next prime minister is a human rights lawyer who once called for the British monarchy to be abolished, but years later knelt before Charles, then Prince of Wales, to be knighted. He was also rumored to be the 1990s inspiration for a brooding heartthrob character in the Bridget Jones movies. Anyways, to go on, he's 61 years old. I mean, that's a claim to fame, right? Bridget Jones movies? Come on. He's known as a social liberal, a fiscal moderate, and leader of the United Kingdom's Labour Party. That's where I want to talk to you for a second. You hear Labour Party and you hear a lot about liberals, the liberal win in the British government. The Conservatives were defeated in this particular election. But the new prime minister is actually considered in some ways a centrist. And keeping an eye on the center and centrist coalitions may be a big story coming out of Europe. Let me also show you what happened in France. There was an unexpected result, at least in France, from what we saw in earlier elections, where it seems that the conservatives were gaining ground in the French government. And when all was said and done this weekend, that doesn't seem to be the case, that you were able to see that the conservatives didn't have the same sort of majority that was expected. In fact, what French voters did was something very interesting. They split the legislature, this is from the Associated Press, on the left, center, and far right. leaving no faction even close to the majority needed to form a government. The results from Sunday's vote raised the risk of paralysis for the European Union's second largest economy. But if you look at these headlines, leftist surge foils far right, but French election ends in deadlock. And you see this one, French far right receives a resounding non-mercy, non-mercy. You may think that, oh, the left got this huge win in France, but that's not the case. The left and the center groups bound together to try to collect the votes to block the conservatives. But the conservatives still gained more seats than they've ever had. And that could be missing from the headlines. So one of the things I'm really watching out of Europe, again, if you look past some of the initial headlines of a labor win, a leftist win, this, if you look past it, you look a little deeper, there's some wins there for those that are advocating for a center. Now, what the center looks like is a big question. And that's something that's emerging from Europe. So I thought that was interesting going into a brand new week where we're going to be paying close attention to politics here at home. As far as what's happening back here at home, let's talk about that. You have Congress back in session. So you got all the lawmakers back on Capitol Hill. And so they too are not going to be able to hide behind their staff or press releases or social media accounts. They're going to be face to face with their colleagues again and doing any number of different regular business that they're going to have to do in Congress as we lurch towards Election Day. And there's a question about what actually Congress will accomplish in such a politically heated environment. But the press is going to be a factor this week on the Hill because everybody's back. And the press is going to be waiting to talk to all sorts of people on the record. And even if they talk to someone in the morning, they're going to want to see if there's developments in the afternoon. There's also going to be all these meetings that are usually weekly meetings that take place between Republicans and Democrats, you know, on their own side, in their own quote unquote teams. Well, now we know one of the big topics of conversation behind closed doors is going to be the future of both of these political parties. And not only the health and vitality of the president currently, but also his health and vitality as well on the campaign trail. There are some questions for Republicans, too, about the strategy they're going to take in all of this and how outspoken they're going to be on this particular issue. But the important thing to know is everyone's back, so you're going to hear a lot of sound bites. And the press is not going to let this go. It is like that storm that's going to be sitting on Capitol Hill unless something extraordinary happens to break that tension. You also have world leaders traveling to Washington, D.C. In just a couple of days, we have a huge meeting of NATO, the largest military alliance in the world. That's taking place in Washington, D.C. too. And President Biden talked quite a bit about his role in NATO when he did an interview on Friday, his first interview since the debate. And I'm going to play a little sound for you when it comes to that. First, before I do that, though, one of the things that we were greeted with this morning, and let me see if I could pull that up, is a letter that the president sent, I'm going to get a little bit bigger, sent to Democrats in Congress. And I want you to see this letter because he, just like everybody else, was hearing a lot of murmurs over the weekend from different Democrats that are currently sitting in office, some of which who are going on the record saying that he needs to pull out of this race. Part of the concern for Democrats now is not just the presidency. It's a question about how the presidency affects the down ballot races. So let's say you go into the election box and you're going to check, let's say you check a Democrat president. The likelihood is if you have a confidence in that Democrat president, you're going to maybe vote straight ticket down the ballot, which adds momentum. Let's say you're not sure who you're going to vote for president. It leaves those other votes a little bit less certain. And so there's a concern that when there's some uncertainty at the top of the ticket, what that will do for other races and what that will do to the balance of Congress. And so that's what we're starting to see. So here's some of what the president wrote in this letter that he actually posted online for everybody else to see too. It said, "Fellow Democrats, now that you have returned from the July 4th recess, I want you to know that despite all the speculation in the press and elsewhere, I am firmly committed to staying in this race, to running this race to the end, and to beating Donald Trump." He goes on to say, "I can respond to all of this by saying clearly and unequivocally, I wouldn't be running again if I did not absolutely believe I was the best person to beat Donald Trump in 2024. We had a democratic nomination process, and the voters have spoken clearly and decisively. I received over 14 million votes, 87% of the votes cast across the entire nominating process. I have nearly 3,900 delegates, making me the presumptive nominee of our party by a wide margin. He goes on to say, I thought this was interesting. Let me see if I can find it for you. This was a process open to anyone who wanted to run, as he clears his throat and looks directly at Democrats. Only three people chose to challenge me. One fared so badly that he left the primaries to run as an independent. He's talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I'm sure RFK would disagree with that. Another attacked me for being too old and was soundly defeated. The voters of the Democratic Party have voted. They have chosen me to be the nominee of the party. So this is what Democrat lawmakers woke up to on their Monday morning return into work. And this is where the president begins the week. He begins the week with this stand. The question is this going to be sustainable for him, not only over the next several months, but really over the next several days? Because the pressure is building right now. And we'll see, does it dissipate like a storm that blows through, or does it sit and cause some more problems? Let's look at what the interview that President Biden gave to ABC News looked like. For some of you who may have missed this, this was aired on ABC and it was a special report. I want you to hear how ABC introduced this conversation, and we're going to talk about why this is unusual.
A special edition of This Week. President Joe Biden, his first television interview since the debate. The news-making exclusive. Now reporting from Madison, Wisconsin, George Stephanopoulos.
Good evening from Madison, Wisconsin, for a special edition of This Week. The first broadcast interview with President Biden since last week's debate. Earlier this afternoon, we taped the 22-minute interview. There are no cuts, no edits. We have not touched it. At this pivotal moment in the presidential campaign, here it is.
Let's just stop there for just a moment. It is so unusual for any network to lead with that fact. We have not touched it at all. We are just running it. We are not doing any editing. They are trying to aggressively get ahead for any accusation that they helped the audio, that they added some clarity to the answers. And the reality is that if I was doing a sit down with an important lawmaker, and I was part of national network news, the likelihood that I would run an interview beginning to end straight with no cuts is very unlikely, because that interview could last for 25, 30 minutes, but I really am only going to air about 5 minutes. And I'm going to have to edit around when politicians dance a little bit and they tell you something that you didn't ask about and you're trying to get to the actual meat of the conversation. And sometimes, let's say someone starts coughing or they mispronounce something and they back up, you are going to edit around that. Not because you're trying to make them look better. It's just that life sometimes happens. So either you're live 100% on TV and broadcasting live, and then if someone coughs, it's just something. But typically in network news, where you're not doing 24-hour news like cable channels, you're sitting down with someone and then you're going to pick and choose the sound bites to weave together. So this is unusual for ABC to make this sort of proclamation and this sort of format. I'm just going to play a little bit at the beginning of this interview, and then I want to share one other sound bite.
Mr. President, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the debate. You and your team have said you had a bad night. But your friend Nancy Pelosi actually framed the question that I think is on the minds of millions of Americans. Was this a bad episode or the sign of a more serious condition?
It's a bad episode. No indication of any serious condition. I was exhausted. I didn't listen to my instincts in terms of preparing, and I had a bad night.
You know, you say you were exhausted, and I know you've said that before as well, but you came, and you did have a tough month, but you came home from Europe about 11 or 12 days before the debate, spent 6 days in Camp David. Why wasn't that enough rest time, enough recovery time?
Because I was sick. I was feeling terrible. Matter of fact, the docs with me, I asked them, they did a COVID test because they were trying to figure out what's wrong. They did a test to see whether or not I had some infection, you know, a virus. I didn't. They just had a really bad cold.
And did you ever watch the debate afterwards?
I don't think I did, no.
Well, what I want to get at is, what were you experiencing as you were going through the debate? Did you know how badly it was going?
Yeah, look. The whole way I prepared, nobody's fault, mine. Nobody's fault but mine. I prepared what I usually would do, sitting down, as I did come back with foreign leaders or the National Security Council, for explicit detail. And I realized about partway through that, you know, all I could quote at the New York Times had me down at 10 points before the debate, 9 now or whatever the hell it is. The fact of the matter is that what I looked at is that he also lied 28 times. The way the debate ran, not my fault, no one else's fault.
But it seemed like you were having trouble from the first question in, even before he spoke.
Well, I just had a bad night.
Okay, so you got a little sampling of how this question and answers went about the debate. Tamerica, you asked a great question here. Let me go ahead and move this so we can see your question on the screen. I wish he'd balance it out and have a similar interview with DJ Tech. Let's see if I can get that out. DJT or Donald Trump. And what you should know is that George Stephanopoulos at the end of the interview actually said, or at some point in the interview, said that he reached out to the Trump team to request a very similar interview. And I think that is actually really important. There is a part of this interview that gets to another line of questioning about fitness to serve in office. And because in the aftermath of this interview, we actually see some bipartisan agreement on this, I want you to listen to this next soundbite.
Doctor said he consulted with a neurologist. I guess I'm asking a slightly different question. Have you had the specific cognitive tests, and have you had a neurologist, a specialist, do an examination?
No, no one said I had to. No one said they said I'm good.
Would you be willing to undergo an independent medical evaluation that included neurological and cognitive tests and release the results to the American people?
Look, I have a cognitive test every single day. Every day I have that test. Everything I do, you know, not only am I campaigning, but I'm running the world. Sounds like hyperbole, but we are the essential nation in the world. Madeleine Albright was right. And every single day, for example, today, before I come out here, I'm on the phone with the Prime Minister of, anyway, I shouldn't get into the detail, but with Netanyahu. I'm on the phone with the new Prime Minister of England. I'm working on what we're doing with regard to in Europe with regard to expansion of NATO and whether it's going to stick. I'm taking on Putin. I mean, every day, there's no day I go through there are not those decisions I have to make every single day.
And you have been doing that, and the American people have been watching, yet their concerns about your age and your health are growing. So that's why I'm asking, to reassure them, would you be willing to have the independent medical evaluation?
Watch me between, there's a lot of time left in this campaign. So over 125 days.
So the answer,
decision.
The right answer right now is no. You don't want to do that right now.
Well, I've already done it.
I know your doctor said he consulted with a neurologist.
So let's just talk about that for a second. One of the questions I asked you to our live insiders as well to our live Instagram audience is: did you actually see this interview in full? Did you see the whole thing beginning to end uninterrupted? Because I was curious your impressions. Cutting this interview into small clips, 30 to 60 seconds. Part of the reason why I'm playing these longer clips is that you get a sense of the conversation. Because if you just heard 30 seconds to a minute, you may have a certain impression. I want to give you that time, which is exactly what ABC was trying to do and saying, we're going to run the 22 minutes. Here we are. We're going to run the whole thing to see if that can actually provide information to the public. This question about a cognitive exam is one that then less than 48 hours later, came up on the Sunday shows. The Sunday shows, NBC, CBS, ABC, continue to be news-making shows for setting a tone for the rest of the week, which is why I pay attention on Smarter News to them. Even though perhaps it's not something that's necessarily in your television watching repertoire, this is something that still remains really important to us that are trying to gather news to start the week. And so I picked two sound bites. One is from Senator Graham, who represents South Carolina. The other one is from Representative Adam Schiff out of California. Both of these are really prominent lawmakers in their own parties, which is why I wanted you to hear from them. And both of them, whether asked directly, in one case you're going to see he was asked directly. In another case, Senator Graham sort of starts on this question about a cognitive exam, and you'll see he's not limiting his comments to President Biden alone. Take a listen.
What I'd like to see is President Biden take a cognitive test. I think everybody going forward in the line of succession
should have a neurological exam. Should former President Trump take one as well?
On a regular basis. Yes. Yes. I think both, all nominees for president going to the future should have neurological exams as part of an overall physical exam. I think people in the line of succession should have a neurological exam. This is a wake-up call for the country. We need to make sure that the people who are going to be in the line of succession are capable of being commander-in-chief under dire circumstances. Here's what I worry about, that our allies see a compromised Joe Biden, that our enemies see a compromised Joe Biden, and I'm offended by the idea that he shouldn't take a competency test given all the evidence in front of us. He is not only in denial. This is a dangerous time for the American people to have somebody at the ship, leading the ship of state, who seems to be compromised. So at a minimum, take a competency exam.
Speaking
of President Biden and Trump.
Congressman, what is your opinion? I mean, you watched that interview on Friday, and a lot of Democrats say it was fine. He certainly seemed stronger, more robust than during the debate, but it didn't put concerns to rest. Are you confident he can beat Donald Trump, or do you think he should drop out of the race?
The interview didn't put concerns to rest. No single interview is going to do that. And what I do think the president needs to decide is, can he put those concerns aside? Can he demonstrate to the American people that what happened on the debate stage was an aberration, that he can and will beat Donald Trump? I think if the president takes the time to consult people and has an open mind about this, he will do what Joe Biden always does, which is he will make the right decision. You make the decision in the best interests of the country. That's what he has always done, and I'm confident that's what he will do here.
You heard Nancy Pelosi say that it's legitimate to ask, was this an episode or a condition? President Biden refused to commit to take a cognitive test. Do you think he should take a cognitive test?
Look, I'd be happy if both the president and Donald Trump took cognitive tests.
So that's a yes. You think he should take a cognitive test?
I think they both should be willing to take a test. I think, frankly, a test would show Donald Trump has serious illness of one kind or another. But ultimately, the decision is going to come down to what Joe Biden thinks is best. And if his decision is to run, then run hard and beat that SOB. And if his decision is to pass the torch, then the president should do everything in his power to make that other candidate successful.
Okay, first of all, I think that might have been our first reference to SOB on Smarter News. So here we are. We're in a whole new territory. Second of all, cognitive tests for everybody. Let's just all get one. At this point, I probably need one. I will need one by the end of this news cycle. You have to watch for patterns in the news. Do I think that Senator Graham and Congressman Schiff got together and talked about this ahead of time? No, absolutely not. But the fact that we're hearing similar things from different lawmakers from different parts of the country going on national media saying, let's just do these tests, makes me wonder what we'll see next. Is there, we have no idea. Could we see some sort of, I don't know, could you see a law passed requiring this? We already know that presidents, you know, voluntarily go through these physicals. Could this be the pressure breaker where President Biden and President Trump agree to do this and the public's able to turn the page? When you see a drumbeat that starts to match, I just think it's important to put on your radar. I don't know what it means yet, but this is what the conversation was on Sunday going into a whole new week where you're going to have a lot of activity in Capitol Hill and a lot of questions about the future. There's a reason why I'm spending so much time on President Biden. I thought it was important to underscore this, as some of you are bringing up, Tamerica, you brought up a great point about this, which is, well, what about Donald Trump? And the news is definitely focused on President Biden right now, but it's worth pointing out why. He is the president of the United States, arguably the most powerful country in the world, the largest economy in the world. And the stakes here are really big, not just for the election. It's not just about politics. And in fact, you hear that from both Senator Graham and Congressman Schiff about a concern for the here and now in their interviews, the way that they were talking about the stakes for where we're sitting at this very point and the confidence of the American people in our leadership across the board. So it is a big news story. And I don't want to devalue it by saying, oh, the press is just hyper-focused on this. The press did come to this story in a way that the press could no longer ignore. There's been questions about President Biden's health and mental well-being for quite frankly, years now. It's reflected in polling that it's been a concern for the American people across party lines. This is not a new story. What is new here is that the debate made this question of President Biden's health so big that the press could not choose to ignore it. That editorial conversations that take place in newsrooms all across this country about what to cover and what to shrug off could not ignore this story. And suddenly you see this, what feels, could feel, especially if you're a supporter of President Biden, as overkill by the press. Why is there all, is this enough? Is there, now the press is becoming part of the story because of the hyper-focus on it. At the same time, it is a big story. So we have to balance it. So we'll continue to watch what happens. You have, again, more Democratic lawmakers coming out that are sitting on the record calling for President Biden to drop out of this race. You're also seeing thought leaders in the Democrat Party doing the same. Does it stop? Does it slow down? Or does it gain momentum? That is going to be the question for the week ahead. So let's talk a little bit about the Republicans, though, too, because the decision that we got when it came to the Supreme Court and presidential immunity, it's hard to believe was just a week ago. But the ripple effects from that were extremely significant in how they affected major news stories moving forward for President Trump. So I just want to walk through that. Again, in review, the Supreme Court said, although ruling against former President Trump's team and their assertion that the president has complete immunity, the Supreme Court said in some cases the president does have immunity for official acts. In other cases, has no immunity at all for unofficial acts. And in some cases, there's a gray area about specific questions that the Supreme Court is not going to answer because it's up for whatever judge that issue is in front of to figure out. And one of the reasons why we raise the question about what this will mean for the legal system is every single disagreement about whether something's an official or an unofficial act can be ruled on and appealed and potentially even appealed to the Supreme Court. So we could see years of litigation to clarify what's official and what's unofficial in just the case that President Trump is facing in Washington, D.C. about election interference alone, let alone for any of the other cases. Coming into this week, we expected to get a sentencing for President Trump, who was convicted of multiple felonies in the state of New York. The judge of that case late last week said, no, we're not doing that anymore. We have to delay that sentencing out at least until September. And at that time, I will come back, the judge is saying, and let you know how the Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity may or may not have affected this case and the ability to essentially give a sentence. Reading between the lines, there could be the question about whether or not the case as it stands would need to potentially be tried again. That would be very extraordinary, but we're in extraordinary times. Here's how this works. The presidential immunity ruling and making these different categories, official, unofficial acts, and then the gray areas, it's not just about the case itself that former President Trump is facing in a variety of different courts. It's also about the evidence that is being used. So, for example, in the New York, quote unquote, hush money case or hush money trial, there was presentation by the prosecution of tweets or conversations that the president had while in office. And one of the things the Supreme Court said in their decision was that any communication with the American people could be considered an official act. So let's say a president of the United States was on Twitter talking about something and putting it out to the world, that could be considered an official act and therefore cannot be part of prosecution. So is the situation in New York is a question about evidence and what evidence was used in this case that could have been key evidence to convince a jury to convict the former president. And if some of the key evidence is now considered official acts and cannot be included, how much does that change the case and the result? That's where we're at right now. Pause in New York. In Florida, the Florida case, where you also have the special prosecutor is leading that case when it comes to classified documents. There's a different judge, different personality, different background. And there's been all sorts of questions about the judges in all these cases. Let's just put that aside for a second. Former President Trump's lawyers in this case said to the judge, we need to pause this trial to consider the presidential immunity decision. And also, we would like to raise what Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in his opinion. Now, there's the majority opinion of the court that establishes the law. And then you have dissenting opinions and you may have concurring opinions where the justices want to write their own thoughts on this particular issue. Those are not part of the decision or the new law. These are more like the judges expressing themselves. So they can be used by lawyers, but they're not the actual part of the official decision in the same way as the majority decision is. I hope that makes sense. It's not like they're writing personal essays. It matters. It's reflecting their opinions. And especially the dissenting opinions are important to consider where judges don't agree. But there's a question about how consequential they can be other than just sort of an ideation by the judge or a theory by the judge. Justice Clarence Thomas raised the question about the role of a special prosecutor and whether a special prosecutor by the Department of Justice is constitutional and whether or not a special prosecutor like the one overseeing these two vastly different cases against former President Trump should essentially have the position that he has. A special prosecutor has been used for decades by the Justice Department. It's not new. But this is the first time where we're seeing a justice like Clarence Thomas in such a high-profile case raise a question about the existence of a special prosecutor. So we'll see. We'll see what the judge in Florida decides on these requests. So you can see this decision on presidential immunity did have immediate impact. There's a question about the larger impact and the behavior, you know, how much the lack of criminal prosecution of a president in the future will affect decisions by a president. But there's this immediate effect on these cases, and we weren't sure what that effect would be. So now we're seeing it. And the bottom line is all of these cases are likely affected in some way. We're either seeing it for real in New York where the sentencing isn't happening, at least for now. And we'll see how it shakes out. You have you have the cases in states, New York and Georgia. You had the federal cases in Washington, D.C. and Florida. The likelihood we see any major progress on any of these cases before Election Day is TBD. And just as we may see a sentencing of a former president in September, right before the election, we could also see the case against him or the trial thrown out. A lot of possibilities are on the table right now. So it's important to know that. In the meantime, you have the Republicans preparing for their convention, which is going to take place in just about a week. They are first, and the Democrats are later in August. So both parties have a little bit of time. And where President Trump is going to go into the convention to presumably accept the nomination from his party after being a convicted felon and getting a sentence in some way, that's no longer going to happen. The sentencing, again, is tabled, and he comes into the convention, and the Republicans start their convention, at least from today, with some strength at their backs, because the attention is no longer really on them. It's on President Biden and what the Democrats are doing. At least strategically, that's what's going on. I want to just touch on real quick, a lot of you had questions about a case in the Supreme Court that didn't get as much attention about presidential immunity. I just want to touch on it really quickly. You may have seen people reference the Chevron case or overturning Chevron or the Chevron decision. Let me just explain a little bit of what this is about. So it's really about a balance of power. And we have to think about our kind of three buckets of government. You have the legislative branch with Congress, you have the executive branch, which is the president, and also federal agencies we can put underneath that. And then you have the judicial branch, which we have all our courts. And so there was a ruling several decades ago, Chevron, that said in a case where there was a federal law or policy that was being challenged in court, that a judge really should defer to what's established policy or established practice in a federal agency to help make a decision on a particular case, that there should be a deferment to the federal agency. So let's say there was a question about the legality of healthcare in some way in America. And so the judge was overseeing the case, said, okay, I'm going to have to make this decision. I'm going to defer to the Department of Health and Human Services because they're experts on this and they run Health and Human Services. So I'm going to defer to their policy or their decision on this issue. And I see, yes, there's their decision or their thoughts on this. I'm going to use that in my decision on this particular legal challenge. So there was a deferment to the federal agency. What the Supreme Court ruled in overturning Chevron is saying that automatic deferment doesn't have to happen. So now, if there is a challenge, a judge can say, I am going to reference what Health and Human Services did or the Department of Energy or whatever agency that's somehow connected to this legal challenge. The judge can still decide to do that, but it's not an automatic deferment to that particular federal agency. And if you think about it in this way of a balance of power, it's a way of saying, no, the judiciary gets to be independent and doesn't have to defer to something that falls underneath the executive branch, because that would be deferring to the executive branch. And we have three equal balanced powers of government. This is, or branches of government. So that's one way to look at it. There are those that are saying this is going to be one of the most significant decisions that we've seen from the Supreme Court, more than any others that's received any press, because the question is, well, then how much power do federal agencies really have if their policies or their expertise is not deferred to, and judges are more independent in their decisions, then what does that mean for legal challenges? And what does that mean for the power of these federal agencies? And so there's both criticism and support for this ruling, but it's sort of under the radar. And I just want you to know that it happened, and we don't really know the effect of it yet. We don't know how independent judges are going to be looking at these issues and perhaps not even deferring to federal agencies anymore, or continuing to do so because they choose to do that. It's just now they don't have to automatically do it. I hope that makes a little bit of sense. It's a tougher ruling to kind of wrap your head around, because it's one that would be very specific to a legal challenge that also impacts or is connected in some way to federal agencies. And so I didn't want to pull too many examples, because we don't really know how this is going to be used by judges. So hopefully that's helpful and answers some questions for those of you who had them. Final thing I'm going to cover today is Project 2025. And the momentum that Project 2025 has received online is like nothing I've seen really recently. What is Project 2025 and where have you heard about it? Here's an example. This is from Hollywood actress Taraji Henson.
It's about making decisions that will affect us as human beings, our careers, our next generations to come. The Project 2025 plan is not a game. Look it up.
So she said this on stage. That got a lot of attention. And then you saw Mark Ruffalo with a tweet. I mean, this is all a lot of Hollywood celebrity. I want to show you this to you because that way you can see, well, where is any of this coming from? Here's what Mark Ruffalo said after that. He said, Project 2025 is not a game. It's white Christian nationalism. It is the Sharia law of the Christian crazy people who aren't Christian at all, but want to control every aspect of your life through their narrow and exclusionary interpretation of Christ's egalitarian, inclusive, and kindly teaching. Don't be fooled by Project 2025, extremist and perverse ideology. Trump is bringing it all to our lives. It goes on. So this weekend, actually, I was asked by two teenagers about this, which, again, surprised anything that has to do with politics. When you hear young people talk about it, like, what, where is this coming from? What is Project 2025? I hadn't heard that much about it until recently. And with many of you, it's because of the questions that you've asked. So thank you for that, because it's really important to get some clarity on this. And this is also important. The news is not here, and my belief in journalism is not to tell you how to feel about something. I want to show you the different opinions on it to understand why is it making news, not to convince you that that's correct. It's to show you, oh, there's different opinions on this. Here's one of the reasons when people talk that fervently about something, here's how it becomes more viral. But really, it's to explain, here's the background, and then you can decide how you want to feel about it. So Project 2025 is actually a project of the Heritage Foundation. So let's back way up. In Washington, D.C., and really all around the world, there are thousands of think tanks. What are think tanks? Think tanks are organizations where people come together to think about a particular issue. That's why they're called a think tank. Oftentimes, they put together policy suggestions or advice or guidelines that can be used as research to help support a certain worldview. You have to be very careful as a journalist what think tanks you often reference, because sometimes you don't know where their funding comes from. For example, in some cases, you could have a think tank that's issuing a report on the Middle East, but they are funded by Saudi Arabia. So maybe their write-up on a certain issue is more favorable to the Saudis because they're getting support from Saudi Arabia. You see what I mean? So you have to be very, very careful about where think tanks are getting their money. And you need to understand what is their point of view. Sometimes think tanks are nonpartisan. Sometimes they are conservative. Sometimes they are liberal or progressive. And so the source really matters. The think tank ethos or their mission really is important to understand. The Heritage Foundation is one of the most prominent think tanks, I'd argue, in the world. It is a prominent conservative think tank. It's highly referenced when it comes to experts on a variety of different subjects. For example, if I was live on the news as I once was, and let's say a topic came up today like the Chevron ruling, I could reach out to the Heritage Foundation and say, I need a conservative voice on this ruling. Do you have someone? And they may say, oh, yes, we have our Supreme Court expert so-and-so. They're available. And I would reach out to another think tank that had more liberal perspective, ask for an expert, and then I would book those two people on TV so they can give two different sides of the topic. The Heritage Foundation in general has been a voice that you will see often quoted in the media, but also tends to have parallels with some conservative thinking for sitting lawmakers. I want to be very careful with that. Think tanks are important in that they bring up different ideas. They provide voices on issues, but they're not decision makers. And there needs to be an understanding of how much an idea in theory can actually be put into a decision. It is often true, whether it's the Heritage Foundation or other think tanks, that someone could have a career in Washington, D.C., working, let's say, for a Democratic senator, and then spend their next decade at a think tank somewhere. Vice versa, someone could have spent time in the Trump administration and then worked at the Heritage Foundation and then perhaps gone back into politics. There's a little bit of a revolving door there between some of the think tanks and those that have worked in politics in a variety of different ways. So now that you know that, the important thing to know is that the Heritage Foundation put forward what they consider their guidelines of what they would like to see conservatives advocate for in 2025. This is their vision for what conservatives need to prioritize. And according to the Wall Street Journal, they put out this vision every 4 years. So Project 2025 is the latest in an iteration over the last several years. They actually published Project 2025 that now a lot of folks are speaking about in 2023. So it would be ready for the 2024 election cycle. So it can do exactly what we're doing right now, which is to speak about Project 2025. Now, there's a question about how much their vision is what conservatives and Republicans are both going to run on as a promise and also actively try to pursue in office. And as a journalist looking at this, when I kind of uncovered all this, I was like, okay, interesting. Absolutely something that I need to be aware of to see, do I start seeing or hearing Republican lawmakers in any way start repeating what I could read about in Project 2025 as a matter of priority? Let me give you an example of some of the things that Project 2025 advocates for. We used a couple examples in our newsletter that's going out today. So, for example, getting the FDA to withdraw its approval of chemical abortion drugs, or allowing state and local law enforcement agencies to participate in immigration and border security actions. Those are some examples. Project 2025, you can read hundreds of pages on it if you'd like. But I want you to have that background of instead of focusing on a think tank. For me as a journalist, important to see, want to see if any Republican lawmakers start to parrot the Heritage Foundation's priorities. I want to watch that. But what I would like to spend more time on is actually focusing on what are the policy platforms of politicians currently serving in office and what they're promising in the future. Think tanks can influence thought, but whether or not they can influence actual decisions or priorities is something else entirely. So important to know, the Heritage Foundation is a leading think tank when it comes to conservative thinking, but not decision makers and not in elected office. President Trump came out this weekend and he issued a statement actually on this. He said, "I know nothing about Project 2025. I have no idea who is behind it." Actually, if you look on the website, it shows you who the writers were. "I disagree with some of the things they're saying, and some of the things they're saying are absolutely ridiculous and abysmal. Anything they do, I wish them luck, but I have nothing to do with them." So I will make sure to put some links to Project 2025 because I think it's important for you just to know the source of it. And that way, if you'd like to look through it, and if you have more specific questions on platform pieces that are coming out or platforms being advocated for, we can dig into those specifics. This does bring up a really important question, I think, for the Trump campaign, though. And if you go back to the debate, everything was about what happened with President Biden. But one of the questions that was answered in the debate that President Trump did not answer, which was a question that we have asked over the last couple months, since President Trump said the statement, he said, "I am going to advocate for or run the largest deportation effort in American history. This is part of his immigration or border policy." But he hasn't been specific as to what exactly that looks like. Like, what exactly would that look like? How would you actually do that in real time? How would you execute that? And the reason why I'm mentioning that is that both parties arguably have this issue with where we are in the election cycle, which is both President Biden and President Trump are trying to make the election a referendum on the other person, but they're not really mapping out a clear vision, a policy vision of what America looks like over the next 4 years. Like, what is the top challenge you see? How are you going to solve it? What do you think is the main priority for the American people? How do you aim to fix it? What are you doing to improve X, Y, and Z? Those very specific policy conversations, interviews have not happened. And I want to mark that they've been absent. President Biden's team will say, "Well, we're going to do more of the same. Look at all the great accomplishments we've done." And you hear him talk about this in his interview with George Stephanopoulos. But if I asked you, what is the one thing that President Biden is going to do when he takes office next, would you have an answer? And would you have the same ability to answer if I asked you about President Trump? It seems we have a lack of information, and it's time to get a little bit more detailed. We're getting closer to Election Day. So one of the things I'm curious about going into the Republican convention is, will we get some more details? President Trump will give a big speech. How many details are we going to get? What does that actually look like? You know, President Trump talks about Make America Great Again. One of the salient things about that slogan is, you could say that. Well, President Trump's going to make America great again. How specific does he need to be to get voters inspired to turn out for him? Because the question that we raised after the debate continues to be a question right now, which is, yes, there's some concern about President Biden, but is it enough concern where an independent voter said to themselves, "I'm not going to vote for President Biden, and I am going to vote for President Trump"? Because the elections over the last several years have been so, so close, that's going to be the decision that has to be made by voters that will change the outcome. So I want you to pay attention. If there's something that we can all help each other with, just pay attention for the specifics. What are we hearing specifically? Not from think tanks necessarily. We're going to watch that. We're going to watch all of them. And we're going to watch editorials. We're going to see what starts being repeated. But we also want specifics from our leaders. What exactly are they advocating for? How are they going to do it? So that's where I think we need to sit today. And that's what one of the things I'm really thinking about is, we're going into a week where there's going to be a lot of attention on things like cognitive ability, cognitive tests, and are we actually going to get some of these specifics? Okay, Aubrey's asking a question. Let's go ahead and see. Do you think part of why we aren't getting details is because they've been president already, so Americans already know how they run things? I think that's part of the strategy, Aubrey, that they say, you already know me. And by the way, you already know the other guy. But is that enough? It might be part of the strategy. Becca is saying, yes, thank you, Jenna. I'm over speeches and need more answers from leaders. Tamerica is saying, I want specifics. One of them has my vote, but I still insist to hear their priorities and their goals for the next 4 years. I think it's really important. I think it's really, really important. Question from Instagram. If President Biden steps down from running, who runs in his place? That's a great question. And we don't know is the answer. There's a couple different ways that this could happen. President Biden could step down from serving as president, in which case the vice president would become president. And we could walk through kind of this way that there'd be a structure in place. And presumably that would also mean that he's no longer running for re-election. He could continue on as president and decide it would have to be his decision to step away. And that would leave a big question for the party about who would actually become the nominee. Would it be Vice President Harris? Or could you see a vote that took place at the convention, the Democratic convention in August, to elect who would be at the top of the ticket? But right now, it's really up to President Biden. The focus is on President Biden for a reason, because it's really up to him. The party can't force him out right now. The voters have already voted for him in the primary. And that's part of the point that he was making in his letter to Democrats. The voters have already chosen me. So what are you going to do? Go against them? Not a good look. Also, probably not logistically possible. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. This week is going to be really interesting. Okay, I'm going to leave you with this final thought and hopefully we'll make you laugh. Some of you may say to yourself, I'd really like to get away from it all. Jenna, I'd like to, I need a break. I'm going to take my social media sabbatical like Barbara is on our insider feed. I'm going to go to a deserted island somewhere. I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to go spa. There's all sorts of, we have a lot of different ideas of things that we can do. I think all of them sound pretty good. What happens if you just lived in a Mars habitat for an entire year? Let me read to you what these NASA folks just did. The crew of NASA's Earthbound simulated Mars habitat emerged after a year-long voyage that never left Earth. The four volunteer crew members spent more than 12 months inside NASA's first simulated Mars environment at Johnson Space Center in Houston, coming out of the artificial alien environment Saturday around 5 p.m. The mission commander began with a simple hello. It's actually just so wonderful to be able to say hello to you all, she said. Jones, a physician and the mission medical officer, said their 378 days in confinement went by quickly. That's a quote, went by quickly. The quartet lived and worked inside the space of 1,700 square feet to simulate a mission to the red planet, the fourth from the sun, and a frequent focus of discussion among scientists and sci-fi fans alike concerning a possible voyage taking humans beyond our moon. So maybe they'll ask for other volunteers, okay? And we could all just go lock ourselves away in 1,700 square feet and just block out the world. Here's part of that. Part of what they simulated is that if they were on the phone, there was a more than 20-minute delay. So if they were talking to someone that was pretending that they're saying they're on Mars and the person's on Earth, it'd be a 22-minute delay in communication. So that's what they did. And they said it went by quickly. So you know what? Maybe we just all need a little bit of break. We just go a little, you know. We just go to Mars, you guys. It could be a fake Mars, not even a real Mars. We do it for science. We do it for science. I don't know. I see all of you saying, never going to happen. I'm sorry. It's not taking place. I got it. I understand. I just thought it was worthwhile to mentioning. We all just need a little break. Jim's asking a question about the DNC, but I believe, Jim, you also had a question about the Supreme Court that you wrote us about earlier, and I wanted to make sure I answer that too. Some of you had a great question, and this follows in line with a couple other questions. I'm just going to answer this real quick. This question about whether or not a Supreme Court can overturn a law that or a decision it already made, and the answer is yes. The Supreme Court can overturn a decision that it already made. And and create a new decision. And it could happen with the same justices. It doesn't have to happen when you get new justices in. What you're always waiting for in the Supreme Court is a new legal challenge of an existing law. So one of the things we saw, Roe v. Wade was the law of the land for several decades, but then there was a new legal challenge to it. And a new legal challenge led to a new result. So even for some of the things we're seeing on presidential immunity, Chevron, et cetera, even the latest decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, if there's a different legal challenge in the future, we could see a different law, a different decision from the Supreme Court. And it doesn't need to, you don't need a turnover of judges for that to happen or justices for that to happen. So anyways, all right, guys, we did a lot of work. It's probably the longest scoop yet. I appreciate you staying with us, but it was a big scoop. We're all about quick, concise, nonpartisan news, except when we need to dig in a little bit, and we're in very historic times. So thank you for this and for your patience as we're working through it. If you have any questions or concerns, please email us, hello@smarternews.com. And if you'd like to become an insider, which is a great way to support Smarter News for less than a price of an iced coffee that I paid for yesterday, it's $4.99 a month. And once we have to pay our fees on it, it's like giving Smarter News a dollar a month. That's the reality. It's just one way that we're able, think about dropping a quarter into a newsstand in the past. We're trying to figure out a way to break this media cycle where it's just cluttered advertisement is what you need to win. We just don't believe it. So scoop.smarternews.com is where you can go for information. And then you get to join live broadcasts and also for our Scoop Insiders. I'm working on a live interview for you later this week. That's really fascinating that I'd like you to join us for if you have the time. So, consider becoming a Scoop Insider and supporting a free press. Thank you all for joining us and hope your week gets started off great. You got everything prepared so you don't need to look at the news for a little while. Give yourself a break. Go out and do something fun. And I look forward to hearing about your adventure and your story because it's just as important as any of the other stories that we're covering. And we can't forget that. All right, guys, have a great start to your week. And I'll be here always at smarternews.com and at smarternews across social media to help out as we see breaking news develop. We'll keep you posted. All right, talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.